Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. Conspiracy theories often provide convenient explanations for complex or random events to fit and sustain the particular prejudices of their believers. But in this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about the many conspiracies and secretive plots that really did shape the course of events.
Now, Graham, you might remember we had said last week in our last one that we were going to discuss archives this week. And let's try and hold that over for next week, because I was very struck listening last Friday to a BBC radio programme on conspiracy theories. And I thought that although it had strengths, it also had limitations, and I would like to talk about that. So briefly, the programme argued that conspiracy theories essentially dated from a period of globalisation at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, although usefully Sir Richard Evans, the only historian that dissented from that view, drew attention in a sentence to the fact that there had been conspiracy theories at the time of the French Revolution and the 1848 revolutions. And those talking about the programme made some very good remarks, very cogent remarks about the folly of the conspiracy theories linked to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But also, as it were, were inclined to mock the very idea of conspiracy theories, referring in particular to those of recent years in the United States. And what I thought it would be useful to do is to talk a bit about, and then I will happily answer some questions with you, have a discussion, about some of the problems that one faces if one takes that approach. And there are two separate problems that I want to identify. One, that there is a much, much, much longer of history of conspiracy theories and conspiracies, obviously, than was suggested in the programme. Indeed, I think I would fairly say that the BBC sold its listeners very short and provided an extraordinarily misleading account. So I want to talk a bit about that. But separately, I want to make the point that there are conspiracies in history. There are doubtless conspiracies in the present day. And therefore, conspiracy theories are not per se wrong. What is wrong are flawed conspiracy theories, which is an entirely different supposition. And you will recall that we've recently seen, for example, the conspiracies that led to the attack on the World Trade Tower in 2001. We've seen the British government draw attention to the Russian conspiracy that led to poisonings of Russian dissidents in Britain, and so on and so forth. There are quite clearly a lot of conspiracies in the present world. That means, therefore, that rather than debating the question simply by pouring scorn on what doubtless occurs, which are stupid conspiracy theories, there's no shortage of those, it is pertinent to actually address a much harder and more difficult issue, which the BBC programme totally ignored, in my view, which is how best to debate conspiracy theories in a world in which there clearly are conspiracies. But let's start off with actually looking, as I said, at the previous prehistory. Now, beginning it in the late 19th and early 20th century and linking it to globalisation, it was a German scholar that they quoted who did that, the British went along with it, is very faddish but actually rather silly. So to just simply relate to my own areas of research and past teaching, but I'm sure other scholars would be able to do the same. As an early modernist, I was hired as the early modernist in European history at Durham in 1980, one of course is well used to the conspiracies that were linked to and anxieties about them that were linked to the religious wars. I mean, it's not just a conspiracy assassinated in 1589, Henry IV of France in 1610, that people put gunpowder under the Palace of Westminster in 1605, and so on and so forth. Nor is it just a conspiracy theory to note that there were international organisations which were supposed to advance particular causes. Whether you sympathise with them or not, it's another matter. But to sort of take out of early modern history the significance, for example, in the 16th century of Ignatius Loyola's Society of Jesus, better known as the Jesuits, is ridiculous. And so on in other societies. I mean, for example, Selim the First, who was the Ottoman Sultan in the 1510s, was concerned with reason about Safavid conspirators in Anatolia and the attempt there to raise a rebellion against Ottoman rule. You know, he was right to be concerned. I mean, the Safavid movement was very much one that propagated an international attempt to take over on behalf of its particular type of Islam, the wider Islamic world. So these kind of movements, these kind of, if you wish to use the term, and I think the term can be used successfully by, you mean, an organisation with secret plans and or a secret organisation, these were certainly in place in the early modern period, and I'm sure if we had to hand a scholar on the classical age or a scholar on the medieval period, they would be able to draw our attention likewise to conspiracies, whether those conspiracies were concerned primarily on religious and ideological terms, or whether they're concerned with, shall we say, more political and factional terms, not that those are incompatible. Again, if we move forward from the early modern period, there is a major book by John Roberts, which they didn't mention on the BBC programme. John Roberts' most scholarly work was his first book, The Myth of the Secret Societies, which deals with anxieties about secret societies in the 1790s, which are spreading revolutionary views. Now, Roberts is very much focusing on misplaced conspiracy, but at the same time, there were real conspiracies. There were real conspiracies, for example, about, if you're looking at the French Revolution, among both radicals and anti-radicals. Whether you're thinking, if you're thinking about the anti-radicals, the royalists, whether you're thinking, for example, about the Louis XVI's attempt to flee, whether you're thinking about the betrayal by various generals or attempted betrayal by various generals, whether you're thinking of the Quiberon Bay expedition, whether you're thinking of the Chouan, the Vendéen, there were royalist conspiracies just as there were radical conspiracies, such as those linked to French attempts to intervene on behalf of and in alliance with Irish opponents of the established situation within Ireland, and so on and so forth. So the idea, again, you know, we can play this right the way through the 19th century. So the idea that you have a new period is, I think, questionable. On top of that, you know, the speakers made a certain amount of derision of conspiracy theory in the 19-teens and 1920s, and drew attention to some of the more lurid of the invasion fantasists and other such writers. Fair enough, some of these writers were extraordinarily misplaced, as much imaginative fiction is. But let us be aware that the Archduke and his wife were not murdered in Sarajevo because they crashed into a milk float. They were shot dead as a result of a conspiracy, which itself was a matter of great interest, whether it was how close it was to the leadership of the Serbian state is debated, but it was certainly a conspiracy, just as there were German conspiracies to sow disaffection in, for example, Ireland, in the British Empire, and there were British counterparts designed and directed against the Central Powers. So again, it is naive to ignore the actual extent of real conspiracy, and so on if one moves into the early 20s. Yes, we can easily make fun, if you like, of John Buchan or of Sapper and the equivalent agitation, but it was the case that there was, for example, the attempts by subterfuge and other such means to spread the communist revolution, and then subsequently one of the great anxieties of the conspiracy theorists, which was an alliance between German revanchists and communists, was in fact, in practice, from the early 1920s onwards, and it enabled the Germans to use Russian space in order to practice rearmament practice, and well, you know, both sides drew benefit from it. Again, you could easily, in the late 1940s, early 50s, make fun of the Red Scare in the United States, but the practicality is that there were communist agents operating on behalf of the Soviet Union, spying on, in particular, atomic secrets, but on other matters as well, both in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And more generally, the whole period of the Cold War was in part and I would begin the Cold War, as you know, my book, I begin it actually in 1917 itself, is in part a war which is waged by means of conspiracy and subterfuge by both sides. So I am sort of minded to argue that what one has got is a much more continual pattern of behaviour in which international relations and domestic contention are linked, that this is indeed what you would anticipate once you have what you might call a state system. So, for example, in the early 14th century, late 13th century, it's in the interest of the kings of France opposed to the kings of England to stir up disaffection for an opposition in Scotland. Perfectly normal activity. You don't need to be a conspiracy theorist to be aware that that is what is going on at that time. The difficulty is to determine how you assess both those taking part in that activity in a subterfuge, in a faction of subterfuge, and those you might term agents of influence. And the whole role of agents of influence, the whole role of what we now sometimes refer to as soft power, to its exponents, which can include us, we are inclined to argue that this is a reasonable way to act. To our opponents, however defined, and you know, we're looking at this as something that exists around the world, so that our opponents could in some countries be, in fact, if we're thinking of ourselves as some, you know, Iranian or Turkish or Russian politician or police chief, you know, then those people who might be regarding themselves as democratic demonstrators seeking international support could be regarded in their terms as agitators who are being stirred up as part of a foreign conspiracy. So what one, I would argue, is that the actual practice of what we call conspiracy and the actual belief in what we call conspiracy is far stronger and far more long-term and far more complex than the BBC programme suggested.
Well, that's quite a tour de force as an introduction. I mean, I think just to unpack some of that, I mean, you look at such a wide range of conspiracies and plots, and they come at different levels. There is what we might call the court or courtier plot, those close to power who plots it. I mean, Julius Caesar is an obvious example. You know, those close to him plotting his assassination. There's also, you touched upon revolutionary or allegedly revolutionary movements in the period of the French Revolution, plots from below, which are seeking to undermine often not just an individual but a whole system of government, and that can lead through later in the 19th and early 20th century to the anarchist movement, which was extraordinary in its range across Europe and America. I wonder if you can just say, you know, is there a difference between a plot and a conspiracy? Because to me, the two terms are interchangeable.
Yes, I would think they are interchangeable. I mean, I mean, one of the interesting points to draw out is the extent to which they cover the full range of political, social and ideological practice. And indeed, one could add, if one wishes to talk about debates about trusts and monopolies and secret deals between either business people or trade unionists, economic affairs as well. But let's start with, for example, a clear one. There are some areas where we would regard the notion of a conspiracy as totally flawed. So, for example, one of the best books I would suggest in this field, and again, one which shows how fatuous modern secular historians are, is Norman Cohn's Pursuit of the Millennium, in which he's very much looking at apocalyptic thinkers, but also those people anxious about them. And one can take that, which is to do with what one might regard as the religious pathology, but actually point out that, you know, quite a lot of people in the present-day world do believe in good or evil as having a real presence, which is linked to a deistic viewpoint. Now, I mean, where exactly are we going for here? Are we going to argue that belief in the devil... I don't believe in the devil, quite some point, but are we going to argue that belief in the devil is an aspect of a conspiracy because it's portraying a world in which those who are sinful are in some way wicked, and as wicked are less deserving of support, sympathy, and whatever, than the others? I don't know. But certainly, if you go back in time, you will well be aware that conspiracies often linked to the most existential, what were seen as threats, for example, concerns about witchcraft. And I would suggest that what you have today with, shall we say, some of the more formal ideologies of states that are totalitarian is, in effect, an ideology that demands a comparable support. It, as it were, works in its own terms. For somebody like myself or yourself, to say that it is absurd. I mean, I think it's absurd personally, but of course that's not going to be tremendously helpful if what we're going to try to do is understand why do people have these beliefs. I mean, you know, if you scratch the average person, push them hard to actually explain themselves, certainly my experience of two visits to India, is many of them will tell you that Muslims are, you know, they say the most appalling things about Muslims, who of course are their fellow citizens. And obviously, as you probably know, one of the most racist societies in the world with its caste interpretations of organisation is India. Now, you know, to me, this is abhorrent. I mean, totally abhorrent. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that Indian beliefs in Islamic conspiracies, as you may know, this is at the present moment being pushed very hard against the ideas of intermarriage, reflect a society in which those values had some sort of strength to clearly a lot of those people, which in turn therefore actually gives them a real presence, however bizarre they might seem to us.
Well, I'd like to push a little bit further on the difference between a conspiracy, which we can all agree have happened in almost all cultures at almost all times, and the notion of a conspiracy theory. Is there something about conspiracy theory which is different from the study and understanding that every now and again people plot to secretly achieve outcomes which they don't reveal their intentions in advance?
No, because what I would argue is that, in fact, this kind of belief in a long-term alien force which has malign views is something that you get going right the way back. I would argue that you see it as a linked to the identification of groups and therefore in part an identification of any group involves seeing those who are outside that group as real or potential threats, and whether you want to link that to dynasticism or religion, and obviously a lot which the Egyptians construe that as a threat, and the Jews have to leave. And that kind of construction is, I think, one that you see really quite early in human development. If I use the term development without implying any necessarily benign or malign course.
Well, there are some plots, some conspiracies, which seem almost timeless in the sense that they go on in different countries for long periods. I mean, a very obvious one in that context is the Jewish blood libel, which manifests itself in slightly different ways in different countries throughout Europe, but nevertheless is very apparent and then finds its way into different forms of anti-Semitism in the end of the 19th and 20th centuries. Another is ones which are very specific to a time, and it seems to me, and obviously correct me, but it seems to me that there are, to take British history as a case in point, there are cycles, periods where there are quite a number of plots and conspiracies that take place, and then periods when there don't seem to be many. I mean, for example, the religious tumults of the 16th and early 17th century, the Babington plot, Guy Fawkes, and Titus Oates later in the Restoration, and so on. And then there's a kind of period in the early mid 18th century where there doesn't seem to be so many plots, and then they take off again as we move towards the period of revolution. At the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century. And then there seems to be another pause. And then with the rise of Fenian terrorist acts and so on, they start to take off and they become greater towards the end of the 19th century and early 20th century. Is it entirely accidental that there seems to be these phases, or are they just direct responses to moments of acute, often ideological crisis?
Well, that's, again, a very interesting question. First of all, I think it deserves attention and research, this question of cycles or periods. Just on the specific, I wouldn't agree with you at all about the early 18th century. I mean, Jacobitism is very much a conspiratorial movement designed to lead to the return of the Stuart line, seeking foreign support for that end. Seeking to also encourage rebellions in the British Isles, and there was criticism of the Walpole government back from 1720 to 1742 when allegations were made that it played up these threats, but the reality is there were those threats, and of course when you've got Charles Edward Stuart marching as far as Derby in December 1745, then Walpole looks relatively prescient, just as he'd, deployed the army at the time of the Atterbury plot earlier. So, now, in the case of the Jacobites, we're in the happy position of being able to look at both sides. So, well, in fact, more than two sides, not just the government, including British intercepts, Home Office, they were then called Secretary of State for the Northern and Southern Departments, papers, etc. But also there are the Stuart papers, and on top of that, I mean, years ago I was working in Vienna and came across the papers of a man called O'Rourke, who was the Jacobite envoy in Vienna, and was reading his attempts to persuade the Austrians to mount an invasion. That might sound ridiculous, but Austria ruled Belgium in that period. The Austrians to mount an invasion in 1726 when Austria and Britain was hostile. You can also look in the French archives, the military archives, the foreign policy archives, the naval archives, and you can see how the Jacobite cause movement interacted with France. So we can do that, and we can see with that how people who argued, and people at the time and subsequently have argued, that this was all overblown, well, they could spend some time reading some of the military and espionage papers. Indeed, can I just say, I mean, one of the things a point I made in my book on Britain from 1945 to Brexit, was that I was struck at how very little modern history historians of modern Britain, and I would add modern British historians, have actually integrated into their work the intelligence dimension, including, I'm not talking about people like Philby and Burgess and Maclean, I'm talking about agents of influence who were British politicians for foreign states and how foreign states sought to manipulate British politics and vice versa. And that tends to be left out because people can't, well, they don't understand where to look at the material, or they can't find it, or they're disinclined to look for it. There's a whole host of reasons. All the material isn't open for them to look at, and there's a whole host of reasons there. But it doesn't mean that it's not still a pertinent issue. So going back to your question about conspiracies, I suppose if you wanted to argue that there was a period of time in which the British were, as it were, worried about conspirators as, shall we say, terrorists, but not necessarily thinking that they offered an opportunity to overthrow the British state, then you could probably think about the period after the failure of the Chartist movement, or rather, one could say the success of the Chartist movement in holding back from violence in 1848. After that, the next big sense of conspiracy and threat doesn't occur till the Indian Mutiny, Indian War of Revolution, whatever you want to call it, of 1857-9. So you can find a period in the early 1850s when, you know, there are concern about a variety of matters to do with Ireland, which in fact in 1848 was closer to the boil than people sometimes today appreciate. But nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that compared to the panics and anxieties of the 1900s or the 1790s, the early 1850s is not a period of acute conspiracy theory in Britain. But on the other hand, if you go on the continent, you can see the situation in which the president of the French Second Republic overthrows the Second Republic and turns himself into the Emperor Napoleon III. Now, you can either discuss that if you like, and you know, there was fighting, you can either discuss that if you like as politics, or you can say it was a conspiracy. I personally think it was it should be regarded as a conspiracy. I think the seizure of power and the use of the seizure of power in order to force through a change in a political or constitutional context is the result of a conspiracy. And as a consequence of that, you could actually say that that has been a quite high level of frequency, and it tends to be only relatively subdued if you have political communities that very much accept the legitimacy of two sides, or more than two sides, exchanging power through validated processes of constitutional import, which usually in the modern world means some form of democracy or other. And if you don't have that, if you do not believe that it's legitimate to oppose the government, or if you believe that one or other side has a monopoly of truth and virtue, then you're more likely to feel that there is an acute need to protect yourself against conspiracy, however much there might be conspiracies or not.
Do you think that is one factor in, there's still a lot of murkiness about it, but the Zinoviev letter, which was produced on the eve of the 1924 general election, which, is it that your Labour...
Well, there's a very good book on the Zinoviev letter by Jill Bennett, and I would re-urge people, who was the Foreign Office historian, and I would urge people, and who is a good scholar, and I would urge people to look at that. I mean, as you probably know, there was a suggestion that white Russians had forged it. I mean, the practicality is that the Macdonald government had got itself into trouble in part by losing the confidence of Parliament over its decision not to prosecute a journalist called Campbell, communist, who had... in effect, been spreading disaffection or trying to spread disaffection among the armed forces. So there was already a situation in which the a victory for Labour appeared valuable to the Soviet Union. But the reason why Labour lost power as a result of that general election is not because of the Daily Mail and the Zinoviev letter. It's in fact because the Liberal vote fell, and the Labour vote held up well. In fact, the Liberal vote fell, partly to do with the divisions between the Lloyd George and the Asquith Liberals, partly to do with the fact that the Liberals were financially exhausted after the previous general election. And what therefore happened was that the Conservatives did better, and that was enough to put Labour into the wilderness until 1929. And then there's also the wider point, which, as you may know, British ministers and ministries in the 1920s were very anxious about the degree to which the Soviet Union was meddling, and just as the French, it wasn't just the British, but in fact just as about other people as well, Chinese, for example, the nationalist Chinese, they go through periods of feeling that engaging with the Soviet Union is the best way forward, and one should talk to them, and then they go through periods of saying, no, these people are conspiring, and we've got to sort of kick their agents and their envoys out. And as you may know, Soviet position was one of, on the one hand, the Soviets were inclined to believe that others conspired against them, and of course the foreign intervention in the Russian Civil War was not very encouraging in terms of benign relations, but equally the Soviets propagated this view within their own ranks that in a sense class struggle was inevitable. The question was how far to bring it on and how far not to, alongside that there were tensions. There's a very good essay article I read some years ago about Soviet idea for war in 1923, and there were tensions within the Soviet Union, not simply between ministers in the Politburo, but also between, if you like, what you might regard as professionalized diplomats and, if you like, the international Comintern tendency, and then on top of that there are tensions within the military. One of the problems, and you see it today, people trying to assess the policy of a number of states at the present moment is, and this obviously is linked to the question about the validity or not of belief in particular conspiracies, whatever you mean by conspiracy in this context, as we've already discussed, is how do you define, let's say, Chinese policy at the present moment, or how do you define Chinese policy over the next 30 years? And, if you were, you could argue that the Chinese are quite open about their determination to seize control of Taiwan, so that you could argue that's not a conspiracy, it's a declared policy. But on the other hand, you could argue that the means by which they intend or are considering intending to implement that, both in Taiwan and itself and in terms of the possible action or reaction of other states, constitute conspiratorial policies. And if you were Chinese, you could argue that the American willingness to support Taiwan, including more recently to discuss the supply of advanced military equipment, represents a conspiracy that's in the open, but that there are also possibly or really maybe aspects of that are covert, and that those constitute what you might term a conspiracy. So these are tricky issues. One of the difficulties is that a lot of the public debate about conspiracy and conspiracy theory, and I sort of glimpsed that a bit in listening to the BBC programme, but it's not just that programme, has been one which has tended to focus on the idea of a behind a false consciousness on the part of people. So you get false consciousness, obviously, at the present moment. There's the critique of those who are defined by their opponents as populists, and they're held to propagate false consciousness. But ironically, you get precisely the same argument by those groups about those who they say, on the left, who they say are spreading false consciousness through means such as indoctrination through media or universities or what, or whatever. So what you've got is you've got this commonality in which, although people might disagree about specifics, they agree in their view that there is a very wide willingness or ductility on the part of large numbers of people in modern societies. And, you know, people then discuss this in terms of social media, etc., 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 and groupthink and all the rest of it. Now, I'm more interested in the question, obviously, of state and anti-state activity, the conspiracy as understood by and interacting with foreign policy, military affairs, espionage, and so on. And again, if we're looking for precision in language, and generally precision in language is the last thing you get these days, but I think it has always been thus, if you're looking for precision in language, then in a sense, much of the debate about what are called conspiracy theories at the present moment is part of a critique on the liberal left of Trumpism, Brexit, etc., etc., things that are itself different and complex, but nevertheless, and it's on the right, a comparable critique of what is held to be sort of left liberal tendencies, etc., etc. And both the right and the left liberal, I use that term left liberal because in the United States, obviously, the liberal is the term that has more meaning than the left. What you've got in both of these is a degree of rarefication and simplification. And what's interesting is the simplification and the rarefication occurs not just by those propagating whatever conspiracy theory we may be concerned about, but also by those defining and decrying them. So that, in a way, the definition, the argument that there is a conspiracy theory becomes a way to deny those who may have views that you don't like, as well as addressing the real issue that there are, in some cases, completely absurd propositions. It is a totally absurd proposition that Mossad was responsible for the Twin Towers. It is a totally absurd proposition that AIDS or COVID was used or has been used or is being used for political purposes by states concerned or groups concerned to contaminate or destroy other groups. It is a completely absurd proposition to argue that there was some kind of international Jewish plot comparable to what is outlined in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion or indeed in any other document. It's an absurd proposition to argue that Freemasons were part of a malign secret society. So there are absurd propositions, and at the same time, there are other propositions which one could engage with in a, not necessarily agreeing with them, but in a sense trying to understand what people are saying in order to try and throw some light on their ideas. Now, as I said, that's not my prime concern. My prime concern is states, and I mentioned Jacobitism because I wrote a number of books on the age of Walpole, and I was concerned as to the actual nature of the relationships between foreign powers, the Jacobites, and the British government. And there were ones in which you can observe the movements of people on the board, you can observe what they're writing, you can observe what they're saying to each other, you can observe what other people think are being said, and you can then observe how that is discussed in public. So you've got Parliament, for example, in France, there's the secret police reports on public opinion, which is very interesting. I kept in the Archives de la Bastille, very which, when I looked at them, were obviously the Bastille was destroyed, but were for example, in the late 1720s, that Philip V of Spain, who was the uncle of Louis XV of France, might try and push in French domestic politics, as he'd done in the 1710s, or then the French in the early 1730s. They're concerned about Jansenism. Is there a Jansenist conspiracy? If so, what does it concern? And then there's the concern about the factional tendencies within the French government and how these are linked to foreign powers. Now, all of those are ones which are easier to talk about than, shall we say, some of the more modern debates. So in a paradoxical way, one can almost stand the BBC programme on its head and say, you know, if you really want to understand the range of this kind of phenomenon, it's better to look at the past, whereas at the present day, people are so committed or controverted, or it's so unclear as to what is going on, who is putting money into what, that it's not necessarily helpful to, you know, if you really wanted to know what's been going on in the world in the last 6 years, I mean, it would be very useful to have access to a lot of data on international matters, which are, you know, put it mildly, reserved. You know, we had an attempt to understand, for example, the degree to which the Russian government was involving itself in politics in Britain, particularly in Scotland, for example, in support of the Scottish National Party in the United States. It remained very, very unclear the extent of the interrelationship between the politics of Ukraine and both the Democratic and the Republican parties in the United States. It's unclear. A lot of this may only be clear in hindsight. But if you think about the enormous quantities of money available in the world to some sovereign governments, whether it's talking about, say, China or Saudi Arabia, it would be bizarre to imagine that some of that hasn't been sloshing around the domestic political agenda in some societies which are open to influence.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can't end, I think, without reference to a part of the world in which conspiracy theories play a very strong part of the narrative, and that is, of course, the Middle East. And one aspect is that, you know, there have been plots and conspiracies. The intervention against Mossadegh, obviously, in the 1950s, but also the Suez Crisis as well. There is a narrative, an Arab narrative particularly, in which first the British and then the Americans are almost puppet masters controlling developments in the Middle East. What is your feeling about that as a historian, disinterring the bits which are true from the larger carapace of fabrication?
Well, that's interesting. It would be nice in the early 2000s in Syria if the British or the Americans had been able to be puppet masters. I would have thought the Syrian crisis shows the puppet masters, if you wish to use that term, have more generally been Russia and Turkey over the last 10 years, and indeed both Russia and Turkey, as well as the UAE at the present moment in Libya. I think it's the case in the Middle East that there definitely are conspiracies, yes, that many of them are actually local, by which I mean regional. Obviously, it's easier to blame non-Arabs or non-Muslims. But if you're looking, for example, at the anxieties of, say, Jordan from the late 50s onwards, the anxieties were overwhelmingly about the possibility of Syrian or Iraqi, or indeed Palestinian in 1970, attempts to take over the country. If you're looking at the internal politics of the Ba'athist system in Iraq from 1958 to 2003. Clearly it was overthrown in the end in 2003 by an international intervention led by the Americans. But the reason why Saddam Hussein and his predecessor, in fact, had been so bloody was precisely against the fear of domestic insurrection and domestic conspiracy. I mean, one of the great problems in the Arab world is that democracy is often, let's just put it like that, way that you are going to get political change is through what is referred to as conspiracy or plot. And if you include the fact that in many states in the Third World, and here we're not just talking about the Middle East, we could be talking about states like Turkey or Pakistan, Iraq, obviously, in 58, Brazil in 60, one of the ways in which politics occurred was through army interventions, which inevitably were the product of conspiracies, and once the military seized power, they were apt to argue, Argentina, for example, or Chile, or again, you know, Pakistan, that people who didn't want them are or were actively seeking to overthrow them. We have to bear in mind that we do not necessarily see conspiracies as a bad thing. I mean, you know, would that somebody had blown up Hitler earlier. You know, we don't necessarily see conspiracies as a bad thing. If you go back to the age of religious warfare and tension, which I was referring to, Catholics tended to regard Catholic conspirators in places such as England, Scotland, the chap that killed William of Orange in 1584 as patriot, well, good people, and Protestants had the same views. And in fact, some of those ideas continue. I mean, I was much amused. I used to go and talk at a lot of schools, and I remember years and years ago going to Stonyhurst, which was a Jesuit boarding school in Lancashire, and, you know, I arrived early, which is my wont, and a couple of pupils were deputed to show me round, which was interesting for me. And I remember, you know, there was some statue in one place, and one of the pupils, I think it must have been about 11, pointing to this statue and saying, "Here was so-and-so, put to death by the cruel usurper Elizabeth Tudor." And I thought to myself, well, you know, that's one way of looking at history. I'm not going to get involved in this. But, you know, the belief you might argue, Graham, that that the kind of thing that we would like to regard as typical, which I would certainly very much relish if it were typical, of a peaceful democratic societies with the rule of law and an exchange of freedom of expression, a willingness to tolerate those of different views, all of those kind of factors, I would actually say they're much more atypical in world history than people tend to imagine, and that therefore trying to argue that everything else other than those are pathologies isn't going to help us very much.
Well, we must leave it on that call. Professor Jeremy Black, for Unpicking Fact and Fiction in Conspiracies, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Graham.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.